Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this October 2010 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening, Jim Campanella. You'll have to forgive me tonight. I'm just getting over a cold, and my usual dulcet tones may not be up to snuff. Let's just get going here. I have some seriously cool stuff to tell you about. To begin, you may remember that we have been keeping abreast of the newest exoplanet information for the last year or so on this podcast. NASA has just released some statistics that are kind of interesting in relation to exoplanets and the exoplanet search. First, for those of you who are new to the podcast or do not remember what an exoplanet is, it's simply a planet that has been detected outside of our solar system. In other words, a planet orbiting some other star. So, as of September 2010, after 15 years of looking for exoplanets orbiting distant suns, astronomers have made the following great strides. By the way, the first exoplanet was discovered 15 years ago. Number one, they have found 490 confirmed exoplanets, which is quite a number. Two, there are 45 stars that have multiple exoplanets that have been detected. Three, the stars HD 10180 and 55 Cancri have been confirmed to be the record holders for the stars which have the most planets orbiting around them. That is five exoplanets each. Four, the heaviest exoplanet is HD 43848 at 25 Jupiter masses. Five, the largest exoplanet in terms of diameter is CT Cha B at 2.2 Jupiter diameters. Six, the smallest exoplanet found, which we reported on a couple of months ago, is Corot 7b, which is 1.7 Earth diameters. And finally, number seven, here's the one you've all been waiting for. Out of those 490, how many habitable exoplanets have astronomers found? And the answer is none. Zero. Zilch. Nada. Not a one. That's a serious worry among astronomers and among astrobiologists. Why? Well, there's three reasons. First, statistically, at least according to the Drake equation, habitable planets should not be so rare. The Drake equation is an equation used by the SETI folks to estimate the potential number of extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way. It also has as part of it an approximation of the number of habitable planets. Now, we're not talking about planets with life here. We're talking simply about temperate planets with oxygen and water. According to the Drake equation, 10% of all stars should have habitable planets. Well, so far that appears way wrong. It would suggest that we should have found 20 to 50 habitable planets so far. And, well, so far it looks as if that type of planet is about as common as hen's teeth or an honest New Jersey politician. Now, there is an irony here. One thing that the scientists have not widely considered yet is that it may actually take life to stabilize the air and water systems of a planet. It may be that without living organisms, it's impossible to stabilize such a planet-wide system. My conclusion is that if life is very rare, then habitable planets may be very rare indeed, or just as rare as life is. The second worry the scientists have is that habitable planets with life somehow tend to get either killed off or kill themselves off somehow. In this case, we're equating life with just being habitable. The prediction is that there is a limiting factor out there that all intelligent civilizations finally come up against. They discover some horrendous new tech, like the anti-gravity antimatter bomb that destroys all life on the planet. Or perhaps all civilizations eventually poison themselves with their toxins. This would explain why we have never detected a civilization older than ourselves out there. Shouldn't there be a whole bunch, or at least one, according to the Drake equation? And shouldn't their radio or TV signals have reached us a long time ago? It's possible that we are a very young planet, and a very young species, and that we are looking out there at many, many dead planets. The scientists, of course, are worried that we may go the way of those other civilizations. And now they are trying to figure out exactly what the fabled limiting factor may be. The final, most dreaded possibility of all to the hardcore scientists is that several thousand years of Judeo-Christian religion may be right. Humans may actually be unique in this universe. Humans may actually be alone in this endless void with just ourselves and our Creator for company. We may actually be special and the center of all creation. What if we continue to find nothing but rock balls and gas giants out there? What conclusion will we come to then? Well, whatever you believe, I'll just leave those thoughts for you to ponder. Onwards and upwards. This next story is for those of you who have noted my odd use sometimes of accents to, accentuate quotes of scientists during certain stories. There is actually a long and hallowed use of such dialects in radio. I refer you to the audio logs of legendary radio figures such as Raconteur Gene Shepard. My own use of voices has always been done in fun for entertainment purposes and not to denigrate anyone. Longtime listeners to the show will note that over the years I have used almost as many silly American accents as any other accents. Some listeners have written to me applauding my use of voices to keep the stories interesting, and, well, others have been less than enchanted with the silliness. Dr. Shiri Levari of the University of Chicago published a study in the last month in the Journal of Experimental Psychology having to do with accents and credibility. The researchers in the study asked participants to listen to pre-recorded trivia statements and rate them on a scale of truthfulness. Participants ranked heavily accented speakers at an average of 6.84 on the truthfulness scale, compared to 7.5 for native English speakers. That is seriously worrying and disturbing. What's even more disturbing is that a subsequent experiment showed that even when participants were informed about the nature of the testing and what was being tested, their trust in heavily accented speakers was unchanged. That means that even though the subjects knew they were expected to mistrust the accents, they went along with that expectation and continued to mistrust the non-native speakers. In short, their unconscious bias was unaffected by being told about it. Levari, the lead author in the study, said, "The problem here with accents is that they might reduce the credibility of non-native job seekers, eyewitnesses, reporters, or people taking calls in foreign call offices. English speakers, both in the UK and the United States, have a love of silly and endearing accents. I refer you to Balky from the sitcom Perfect Strangers, the Festrunk brothers from Saturday Night Live, the Count from Sesame Street, or Manuel from Fawlty Towers. To complicate this all, the contempt of foreign cadences might not surprise those of us well-versed in American pop culture. All the best villains have accents. Look at the Die Hard movies, or Schwarzenegger's original Terminator, or Boris Badenoff from Rocky and Bullwinkle. And again, the Brits may not be much better with accented villains like Dr. No or Blofeld from the Bond movies. Where am I going with this? Because I do not want listeners to be laughing at an accent, as opposed to listening to the content of the stories I present, I will stop doing silly voices on this section of the show. If it is true that funny accents make things less believable, then I am doing a disservice to the scientists, whether they be from Texas or India. So let's put our prejudices behind us and focus not on whether we can trust accented English speakers, but on what they have to teach us. If you want to hear funny voices from me, then listen to the SF stories that I narrate here on the sofa. The next story speaks to a certain level of hopelessness that I'm feeling at the moment for my memory, which seems to be slowly leaving me as I enter middle age. This is natural, as anyone will tell you. However, there appears to be a history of dementia in my family for anyone who lives long enough. I had three great aunts who lived into their 90s, but they didn't show serious signs of Alzheimer's until they reached their late 80s. My dad is in his late 70s now, and I'm beginning to worry about his grasp of memory. I suspect that if I make it as far as my great aunts did, then treatments will be available to keep memory quite viable even into old age. But at present, there are no such treatments, and I dread what might happen to my father. I thought that since he keeps his mind sharp by reading, puzzles, etc., that he could stave off a major portion of the effects, if they ever crop up, but even that hope seems to be dissipating now. Reports over the last couple of years have suggested that mental exercise lets seniors outrun Alzheimer's disease. And that appears to be true, but the newest findings are that it's only for a while. A new study from Dr. Robert Wilson of Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, which was published in September's Neurology, reminds us that scientists never really know what's actually going on until they have the whole story, and sometimes not even then. Wilson has found that the race takes a tragic turn for the sharp-minded person as declines in memory and other thinking skills kick into high gear. So you are essentially faced with either a slow meltdown or an explosive loss of mental skills over a short period. And frankly, neither one is very appealing. Wilson studied 1,157 healthy Chicago residents with a range of incomes and ethnic backgrounds, ages 65 and older. To gauge mental activity levels, participants reported on how often they watched television, visited museums, played cards or other games, listened to radio, read newspapers, magazines, or books. Each person underwent two or three evaluations over 6 years. At the end of that period, the researchers identified 148 individuals with Alzheimer's disease and 395 volunteers with milder forms of brain disease. Those who initially reported high overall rates of mental activity displayed pronounced cognitive declines after being diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Mentally inactive adults who developed the brain disease suffered moderate cognitive hits. Given individual differences in severity and the onset of Alzheimer's disease, these findings are consistent with a delay of months or years in cognitive decline among mentally active adults, followed by plummeting mental faculties. Quote, "This cognitive trade-off of rapid dementia is a good one if a mentally active person suffers from clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's disease for a shorter period of time," unquote, says Wilson. Still, that is cold comfort if you or a family member has the possibility of getting that dementia. Wilson and his group are now looking for genetic and biological markers which can predict whether Alzheimer's may be on the horizon for you. The next story of the night is an update on yellow crazy ants. Yes, another ant story. It's been a while, hasn't it? You may remember from a few months back that I talked about yellow crazy ants being a scourge on certain islands of the Pacific. The ants get their name from their color and their zigzagging scurrying, and they have crowded out native ants and disrupted ecosystems all over the Pacific. The invaders meet any foe aggressively and release noxious chemicals during battle. A report by Dr. Thomas C. Wanger of the University of Göttingen in the Proceedings of the Royal Society has finally found a predator that can fight back against the ants. It turns out that the common Sulawesi toad in Indonesia is a prodigious eater of ants, even aggressive invading ones. On the island of Sulawesi, the toads readily feast on yellow crazy ants, which are colonizing the island, just like they are in other tropical locations. During a week of toad abundance on Sulawesi farms, test plots hopping with toads had as little as one-third of the invasive ant populations found on plots where fencing kept the toad out. Wanger and his colleagues established that the toads disproportionately prey on ants based on the toads' fecal samples. Quote, "You wouldn't believe how smelly these things are," unquote. The poop samples reveal that some kind of ant accounted for 3/4 of the diet of the toads storming through the test region, even though ants didn't represent a large proportion of the arthropods there. Native ants presumably have long coexisted on the island with the toads, but populations of invaders may be taking a hit. The test plots lay in cacao plantations, and the researchers speculate that the toad's taste for ants may turn out to be a boon for cacao pest control. About every 3 months, the toads leave their usual forest home and surge through the cacao plantations to breed in the water of neighboring rice fields. Toads feasting on yellow crazy ants may help to keep the invaders from crowding out the native ants in the cacao plantations. Other researchers have shown that a rich diversity of native ants helps keep the cacao pests and diseases in check. The authors make an interesting observation about the difficulty in protecting native wildlife in connection to the frog. Basically, the Indonesian Sulawesi natives could not care much less about native animal diversity than they do, but they will protect the frogs if they feel it is of economic importance to them. The last story of the night concerns a silly conversation I had with my 2-year-old, Elijah. My wife and I are still teaching him to communicate, and I was asking him about the properties of different animals. I asked him if cows could fly, and he looked at me funny and said, "Of course not." Actually, he said, "No." That is Eli's no. Not quite like Homer Simpson, but pretty close. Then I asked if cats could fly, and he again told me, "No," after looking at me like I was nuts. "Can birds swim?" I asked. He hesitated on this one since he has seen ducks swimming in a stream in the nearby park. Now, we have an aquarium and he knows how fish swim, which is not how ducks swim, so he was not quite sure how to answer that one. He didn't want to just jump right in and say yes, but eventually I got a very careful and thoughtful yes from him. Finally, I asked, "Do fish fly, Elijah?" And I got an unequivocal answer out of him. "No, that's silly." Now it was my turn to hesitate.
"Okay, Eli, you are right. Most fish do not fly."
I did not finish with "except for flying fish," because I would have just confused the poor little guy. But I got to thinking about flying fish, and I realized I've known about flying fish and that they exist since I was a little kid, but I don't know anything about them. I know they glide and don't fly, but that's about it. Now, out of curiosity, I looked into flying fish and was amazed. I always thought that they glided a few feet and then just fell back into the water, but I was wrong. It appears that flying fish can remain airborne for over 40 seconds, covering distances up to 400 meters at speeds of 70 kilometers per hour. 400 meters is more than the length of 4 American football fields. I was astounded when I read that. And the first thought in my mind was, how in the heck do they stay up in the air for that long?
As serendipity would have it, in the latest issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology, there was my answer.
Not unlike myself, Dr. Haechan Choi, a mechanical engineer from Seoul National University, became fascinated by flying fish while reading a science book to his children. And he decided to find out how it is that these fish can stay aloft.
Dr. Choi could not commercially buy any flying fish for testing. So, after
quite a while of frustration, he headed out into the East Korean Sea on a boat manned by fishermen from the National Federation of Fisheries Cooperatives of Korea. Park successfully landed 40 dark-edged wing flying fish. Selecting 5 similarly sized fish, Park took them to the Korean Research Center of Maritime Animals, where they were dried and stuffed, some with their fins extended as in flight, and one with its fins held back against its body. These were basically ready to be tested for their aerodynamics in a wind tunnel. Fitting 6 Axis force sensors to the fish's wings and tilting the fish's body at angles ranging from minus 15 degrees to 45 degrees, Park measured the forces on the flying fish's fins as he simulated flight. Calculating the flying fish's lift-to-drag ratios, a measure of the horizontal distance traveled relative to the descent in flight during glide, Park found that the flying fish performed remarkably well, gliding better than insects and as well as birds such as petrels and wood ducks. When he analyzed how the fish's lift-to-drag ratio changed as they varied the tilt angle, he found that the ratio was highest and the fish glided furthest when they were parallel to the surface, which is exactly what they do above the ocean. Measuring the airborne fish's pitching moment, he found that the fish were very stable as they flew. However, when he analyzed the stability of the fish with its fins swept back into the swimming position, the fish were very unstable. And that's exactly what you need for aquatic maneuverability as opposed to flying. So flying fish are superbly adapted for life both in the air and in the water. Knowing flying fish almost always fly near the surface of the sea, Park then decided to find out if the fish derived any benefit from the aerodynamic effect of flying close to the surface. Lowering the fish's height in the wind tunnel, they found that the lift-to-drag ratio increased as the fish glided near the floor. When Park replaced the solid surface and put the fish over a tank of water, the lift-to-drag ratio rose even more, allowing the fish to theoretically glide even further. So gliding near the surface of the sea helps the fish to go further. Finally, Park directly visualized the air currents passing around the flying fish's wings and body. He blew streams of smoke over the fish and saw jets of air accelerating back along the fish's body. Park said, quote, "The arrangement of the large pectoral fin at the front and smaller pelvic fin at the back of the fish's body accelerates the airflow toward the tail like a jet, increasing the fish's lift-to-drag ratio even further and improving its flying performance much more." I guess that is much more than I ever wanted to know about how flying fish fly, but it is still very, very cool. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, be vigilant at the next flying fish crossing you come to, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.